The interesting aspect was these two peaks undergo a process known as charge transfer and intensity stealing, and they merge to one peak at 525, which is what you should expect to see in old blood that in fact had coagulated. There it is. This peak here at 630 that you heard the Gilberts talk about the other day is another very characteristic peak. One of the few compounds that shows this double peak like this is what's known as a high-spin iron heme. It's a very characteristic indicator for ferric porphyrins and an ionic link to some type of a material like a chloride. So in fact, both these spectra, the reflection spectra and the transmission spectra, are indicative of heme-containing materials, absolutely. And one is from the whole cloth, one is from one of these microcrystals. This slide has been seen by several other heme protein experts than myself. There's no doubt in any of their minds that, in fact, these are, in fact, spectra that are characteristic of blood-derived materials. And in fact, I showed it to a pair of my colleagues two weeks ago, down in New York, waiting to see whether they'd pick on me for this. They only pointed out I missed a peak. That one peak that's off there to the back, they tell me, is characteristic, in fact, of biliverd. One of the ones I missed that I was sure was noise. Next slide, please. All right, so we've got a lot of tests to confirm the presence of whole blood on the shrimp. First one is that indication I showed you just from the difference in the characteristic photographic impression. We find that the reflection spectra carry indicative peaks of the presence of heme proteins. The microspectra transmission also contain characteristics indicative of heme proteins. Then we did this trick of generating the porphyrin fluorescence that John talked to you about. After we spent the 6 months going through our controls, we treated these materials with hydrazine, which will in fact dissolve aged denatured protein, reduce the iron, pried it out with formic acid, which is a strong enough acid to do that, and then we're able to generate the characteristic red fluorescence that we could see by eye. Because we did this on a whole tape and it did not disperse, we could see this by eye. The quantum efficiency is very high. The characteristic fluorescence is very characteristic. This is a legally acceptable test for the presence of blood in a court of law. The next test that follows it is also a legally acceptable test for the presence of blood in a court of law. If you treat an iron porphyrin material with a reducing nitrogenous agent, you get what's called a characteristic hemochromatin color. When we coated these things, just micro-spotted them with hydrazine, we got this characteristic pink color. We also then did the standard clinical test for the measurement of blood. We treated them with alkaline cyanide and were able to get the characteristic cyan methemoglobin color test. We were able to detect bile pigments in these blood materials, particularly the larger orange globs, by treating them with diacetyl sulfonylic acid and the standard Ehrlich reaction test is developed by Jendrasik and Groff. John Jackson always boggles when I do this, but I teach it to my med techs once a year. We use a standard kit for this, the bilirubin 525 kit by American Monitor, and we're able to show that, in fact, not only did we get a positive test for the presence of bilirubins, but in fact, the test had its proper characteristics. The color was discharged by ultraviolet light in 15 minutes. We have a very sensitive test for the presence of protein, fluoresamine, which is good to nanograms of protein. There is protein in all these blood areas. One of the tests for protein is using bromocresyl green. This is a specific indicator for albumin. It's the same one that's in the albusticks your doctor uses to tell you whether you have albumin in your urine. We got positive tests for this, which indicated that we not only have protein there, but the type of proteins that are associated with human serum. We then treated with proteases, enzymes that dissolve proteins. They dissolve these materials completely, leaving no particular residues. Finally, the microscopic appearance is compared with the controls, agreed with what we'd seen with our blood-prepared controls. And then there was the fact that you've heard the forensic judgment of, in fact, people who are medical examiners and physicians, that in fact these wound and blood marks appear like blood. They have the right appearance. They're rounded on the edges, depressed in the centers, and they look like free flow blood or clotted blood, whatever they're supposed to be in the appropriate places, with in fact cirrus-type additions. So in fact, we have 12 separate tests of blood in his blood, two of which are accepted in a court of law. Now somebody could ask me, is there some other way this could be faked? The answer is yes. I could take a synthetic iron porphyrin, put it in with a protein-like material, and make it today. But the question is, nobody knew any of this chemistry from the 14th century back. The evidence that this blood is his blood is as good as the evidence that the blood in your veins is blood. The stuff that's on that cloth is blood. B-L-U-D, blood. Without any doubt. Next slide, please. All right. Now, there were these problems. As John has suggested, someone suggested this color was from aged yellow protein, and we needed a test to prove the blood was blood. There are several tests for establishing the presence of proteins. We tried a number of them. The standard ones are converted to the amino acids proteins are made from, ninhydrin. We found out that under our conditions, the metals that were present, calcium and iron, will interfere with the test. Amino black and Kumasi brilliant blue are standard histological stains, one of which was used by a previous investigator. But we found from controls that these materials will also stain highly oxidized cellulose. One of the tests for a so-called carboxylic acid cellulose is in fact the fact that it accepts what are called basic dyes. Both these are basic dyes, and therefore they're not specific. Under our test conditions, they don't distinguish between oxidized cellulose and protein. Therefore, they're not going to do you any good. They won't tell you whether you're seeing protein or oxidized cellulose. Bromothymol blue is nice. It is metachromatic. It changes color. These two don't change color. They just adsorb. But we found out it wasn't sensitive enough. There's a standard test called the Biot-Lowry test, which is more specific. It tests for peptide linkages directly. But it wasn't, again, very sensitive. It was good only to about a tenth of a microgram. Bromcresyl green wasn't much better than bromothymol blue, but where we had large concentrations of protein, it was indicative for us for albumin. Then we discovered fluorescein. Now this stuff is a gangbuster reagent. It's specific for primary amino groups. It fluoresces a bright green with shortwave UV, so it can't be confused with any other conflicting fluorescent materials that are there. And it's good to nanograms of protein, which we confirmed in our controls. This is the most sensitive protein reagent that's been used in any of the Shroud studies. And finally, we had another very specific test, which is simply to see if this material you thought is a protein will dissolve with a protease. Proteases are specific for proteins. If it dissolves and leaves no residue, it's a pure protein. Well, we found that when we ran these tests, anywhere we had blood or blood-associated materials, we got evidence for proteins. In the pure body image areas, there is no evidence for protein, nor is there in the water stain margin areas where we did find real iron oxide. So the iron oxide that's there in the water stain margins is not held with a protein binder. There is no aged yellow protein in any of the body image. There is protein in the blood area. This is proof of several things. That there's not a protein binder holding an iron oxide pigment anywhere on the shroud. That in fact, again, that the blood is blood. Now, there are a number of interesting things about the protein things we saw. One of the interesting things that we saw is the things you just saw Sam and Vern allude to. We found those halo areas that they're talking about, which are adjacent to blood areas. We could find fibrils, in fact, were yellow-coated, and in fact gave a bromcresyl green test as well as fluorescein. So there's protein there, and the protein is typical, in fact, of a known serum protein, albumin. And it has the physical appearance of of a blood clot of cinereses. So in fact, this does confirm the forensic judgment that those are, in fact, real wounds. It also confirms, again, the fact that, in fact, someone isn't painting it. For the simple reason, for someone to paint it, you'd have to paint in the ultraviolet. You don't see any ultraviolet, and therefore you couldn't see what you were painting. These are quite nice. We managed to show there is no protein binder, and in fact, the blood judgment and the forensic judgments, the wounds are in fact real wounds that represent real wound images, are in fact confirmed by this chemistry. Next slide, please. All right, the question then became, what is, in fact, the image color due to? If it's not aged yellow protein, what could it be made of? Well, it has to be made out of one of the known elements of structures known to man. Otherwise, again, it's beyond scientific testing. We went through the standard periodic table and picked out every single metal that could give rise to some sort of yellow, orange, or reddish, or brownish color. That is the metal pigments, known ones plus unknown ones. And we set up the test for them, ran all the controls, and ran them off on this. Now, it's important to say a very important thing here about these chemical tests for metal ions and for functional groups. One of the things John pointed out is it is necessary to show a pigment is present if you want to say it's a painting, but it's not sufficient. You have to show it's there in sufficient concentration to account for color. And also, what you see has to be in agreement with other people's measurements and not capable of explanation by other means. That's a very important point, because while some of these tests are not very brisk, we're seeing a color. We worked under concentrated conditions and add reagents that are used as tests for these because they increase the intensity of the color you see by a factor of 10 to the third to 10 to the fourth. So if our tests fail, maybe the concentration we can detect is pretty low, but it means something that's very obvious. It means the stuff is not there in sufficient concentration to have been seen by the eye. So we've got a built-in quantitative detector. When one of these tests fail, it means this stuff cannot be present as an image-forming material on the surface of the cloth. Maybe there. It doesn't matter where it's there. It's not there in sufficient concentration to give you an image you can see by eye. Well, this is nice, because when we went through all this, we found that of this whole slew of metals, we could detect only four. We could find iron. We could find calcium. We did not test for the strontium, unfortunately. We could find silver, and we could find mercury. The silver, we only found in those little particles that were near the scorch areas, and they're obviously debris from the known fire when it was known that molten silver droplets fell on the cloth. There's nothing particularly exciting in finding and explaining that. The mercury, as John said, we found one piece of it along a clear track. We've since found by electron microprobe, both by us and the Air Force Academy team, that in fact there is mercury along that track, but particles away from that track do not show up. And although the painting of the shroud is a severely historically contested fact, it is an incontestable fact, as John said, the shroud has been painted by innumerable artists. So in fact, there certainly is evidence, historical evidence, that the shroud has been in the presence of artist palettes, where in fact pigments could have accumulated in the accidental debris. We found one piece. I understand Dr. Rigi has found one piece somewhere else. Dr. Macrone has reported mercury in one other sample. It is not pervasive. It does not show up in the X-ray fluorescence. It does not show up in the journal testing. We conclude it is an accidental. All right. Now, how about the iron and the calcium? Well, when you wreck linen, you begin to oxidize the surface. That's why it gets corroded. When you oxidize the surface, you produce carboxyl groups. This is a very nice ion exchange agent. That's why we use paper for an ion exchange support in laboratory demonstrations. Two of the elements that will bind quite strongly, common elements found at work, calcium and iron. And in fact, we found all the old linens we had as controls showed strong calcium and iron. Professor Rigi provided us with some Coptic and Pharaonic cloths. They showed calcium and iron. Maria's 300-year-old Spanish linen showed it. Any piece we had showed it. But the thing that we found was interesting, we found there were three types of iron actually on the cloth. This test up here, 3,4-phenyl, 2-pyridyl, 5-phenyl, triazine, sulfonic acid, disodium salt, PPTS, is good to nanogram quantities of ferrous iron. So in fact, to do the iron test, you first have to dissolve what's your suspected sample, then reduce it, and then run the test. Now, when you do this, you have ways of discriminating about different forms of iron present. We found out that in the blood areas, where we have pure blood and no fibrils, we had to digest with a strong oxidant before we could get a positive iron test. And this makes sense because the iron that's bound in the heme is very strongly bound, and you have to destroy the heme ring before you could read it with this test. So that's nice. It indicates to us that, in fact, that iron is heme iron. When we look at the iron oxide particles we saw in the water stain margins, that stuff dissolved with a weak acid. It requires an acid to dissolve iron oxide. It will dissolve with concentrated cold HCl slowly over a period of time, and it then gives us a positive test. However, the iron that's found pervasively over the whole shroud that Larry talked about will give the test directly with no digestion of pH 4 or 5. This is not iron oxide. It is obviously an iron that's held by some type of covalent linkage. The easiest one to envisage is to the aldehydes and carboxyl groups of the partially oxidized cellulosic structure. And so, in fact, that is a covalently bound iron, a coordinately covalently bound iron, chelated iron. And in fact, this is about 85% of the iron that's on the shroud, just like it is in all these other linens we've looked at. So the iron oxide that's on the shroud is only a few percent, and it's found mainly in the water stain margins. How do we explain that? We go back to this cacking process. It went through a fire. If it went through a fire, you've seen that things migrate at the edge of those water stains. If you had calcium and iron migrating in water on heated cloth, they would carry ferric iron and calcium to the edges where it would deposit. Since you carried the calcium, it would be basic. It would form iron hydroxide, and over a period of time would form khaki, just like our khaki. And in fact, the proof of the matter is that we find the two within the internal medulla of the fibers. They could only get there by a precipitation process. Otherwise, the guy who painted this would need a 10th micron hair that he could insert these little particles through the intact joints with. This would be a real feat of magic. All right. So we've been able to explain what we see, and we can easily account for the metal pigments we do see, and there's no evidence that there's an applied pigment. There is no metal ion on here that we cannot account for by natural processes that are indicative of a non-painting process. Next slide. We then did the same thing with all possible types of chromophores that have been suggested sometime that could have resided on this cloth that would have produced color. Vegetable dyes have known types of groups on them that you can test for. It's been suggested that from the excoriation and the high increase of nitrogenous waste and the perspiration, some of those materials could have been on there and produced color in time, like creatinine and uric acid and urea. We tested for everything you could think of that would give a yellow color, the type of characteristic group. Phenols, steroids, riboflavin, indoles, lignin, starch, porphyrins, pyrroles, creatinine, uric acid, urea, amines, nitro groups, aldehydes, carboxylic acid, cellulose, and saponaria. We can find porphyrin across the blood areas, but that's all, not in the image areas. And in fact, we only find in the image areas two chemical tests that are positive. We can get a chemical test for aldehyde, but a standard Schiff leukofusion reaction, and this carboxylic acid cellulosic test, where it accepts basic dyes. The other standard test for carboxylic acid groups puts sodium carbonate on there and look at the bubbles. I couldn't believe it when I read that. I talked to our organicers, that is the way it's tested for. I said there has to be some other way, and found this one in the textile literature. Now, the interesting thing is, we can put the fibrils we see in a series. If we start out with non-image, image, and scorch, we find out that the non-image ones are weak in these two tests, the image ones are stronger, and the scorch ones are the strongest. It's exactly the same progression as we saw in the corrosion of the surfaces. How could these things be formed from cellulose? It's very simple. By oxidative dehydrative oxidation. Now, it turns out there's two ways you can oxidize cellulose structure. Cellulose is the beta-acetal polymerized form of glucose. It's just made out of one of the elements you have in ordinary sugar, just polymerized into a long polymer. If you oxidize this under alkaline conditions or with ionizing radiation, it will give you carboxyl groups only where it oxidizes, no aldehydes. And in fact, if you oxidize linen this way, it stays white. On the other hand, if you oxidize it under acidic conditions or pyrolytic conditions, that's like scorch conditions, then you dehydrate before you oxidize and you get aldehyde groups formed. The chromophore is in fact a conjugated carbonyl group. The ultraviolet absorption peak for conjugated carbonyls, of course, depends on the degree of conjugation. But the peaks are characteristically found between 315 and 350 nanometers. You may remember the peaks you saw yesterday in the Gilbert spectrum and SAM spectrum in the ultraviolet are in fact in the region of 315 to 350. In fact, the evidence on the spectroscopy supports the notion that we find in the chemistry that in fact the image is due to nothing except dehydratably oxidized cellulose. All right, now we wanted to do further tests. Next slide. So we gilded the lily. There is an archaeological chemist by the name of Saltzman who's worked up a solvent series that is known to dissolve every single known dye, synthetic or naturally occurring, from dyed textiles that is used by the archaeological chemist. We tried all of those. The yellow color does not dissolve in any of them. If in fact we're oxidized cellulose, it shouldn't. It didn't. Furthermore, if there are plant pigments on here, all known plant pigments are either redox indicators or acid-base indicators. 8 normal KOH and concentrated HCl do not change the color. There's no simple dye indicators. Weak oxidants and weak reductants do not change it, but strong oxidants and strong reductants do. Hydrazine will bleach it slowly, diimide very rapidly. Neutral peroxide won't touch it, even if it's 30% superoxyl. Alkaline peroxide will, in fact, discharge the color. Again, those are typical of the chromophores expected from a carbonyl group conjugated in some way to another carbonyl group. One of the interesting things we found, in fact, when you treat the non-image fibrils or the control fibrils with sulfuric acid, in about half an hour, they turn yellow and are absolutely microscopically and chemically identical with shroud fibrils. So in fact, we have got the chemistry of what's on there. We know the chemistry of the image. One of the other things I should point out that's interesting, when we put proteases on the protein-coated materials, take the protein off and then go back and look in phase contrast, they most closely resemble the non-image fibrils. So in fact, this is sort of suggestive that in fact the blood materials went on before the image-forming process, which is one of the conclusions that could have been drawn, in fact, from the sort of stuff that Sam and Vern were saying. So we've again come to the conclusion that, in fact, this stuff is, in fact, the color. A conjugated carbonyl is the chromophore, formed by a well-known natural process, dehydrative oxidation of the cellulose structure of the linen itself. Next slide. Well, this presents us a problem. This is a painting. It's a painting by Maurice Escher. And you see, you start out thinking you know something, you go along and you fall off a waterfall and find out you're back where you're starting. This is our problem presently with the shrimps. Our problem is we know the chemistry of the image, we know the physics of the image, but we don't know how to put the two simply together. The types of things John Jackson talked to you about would suggest the image was made by some type of projective radiation process. I've just told you that would give us the wrong chemistry. That would give us carboxyl groups only, no aldehydes. On the other hand, we've told you that chemistry is suggestive of something like a scorching process. We've absolutely proven, I hope to your satisfaction, it couldn't have been painted. Some nut could not have painted this with sulfuric acid. You need a 3-foot brush with a 10 micron hair. You'd have to paint things inside the joints, show no capillarity, touch the individual tops of the fibrils. It's just clearly impossible, mechanically, physically, or chemically, to conclude that this is a painting. Absolutely not a painting. But the trouble is, if we use the scorching process, you'd have all those problems John talked about in the image formation. You would not get the resolution. You would get severe distortion. You get things which we see are not characteristic of the image. So we do not have a simple explanation of how that image was formed. We've actually answered one of the questions we set out to answer. We can tell you what it is, but we can't tell you at this point how it got that way. Now, a little bit later, Sam's going to tell you some ideas he has had. on some non-simple mechanisms that, in fact, might give us a way of putting these two pieces together. Next slide. So this leaves you with the present status of the chemistry, with the mystery of the man on the shroud. We know what, but we do not know how. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. Can I have the lights, please? We have the lights. I think we take a 10-minute break now. There are restrooms upstairs in the back. There's a tent across the street that I believe has refreshments. See you back here in 10 minutes.
Smearing of the image with the smear.
That's so there.
No, it's like somebody pricked the body like a balloon.
Yeah.
And it wasn't there anymore because you could not have removed the shroud.
Or puffed it off or something.
Yeah. You're getting plenty of heart. It fits in because that.
Yeah.
That's why they're so reluctant to ascribe. They're not going to, obviously, a supernatural in conjunction with a natural event. But there should be one right on the desk, though.
Yeah, I think there should be.
My dream is the best thing. Whenever you're trying to measure the man on the shroud in millisecond, radiation or X-ray ranges. He has a tendency to pollute us.
Yeah. Well, that's all they can do. All we can do is
scientific examination.